Good afternoon, everyone. Patrick Brenner here, president of the Southwest Public Policy Institute. Thank you again for joining us for another episode of SPPI TV. We're on episode 12, and we're here today to talk Bitcoin, and decentralized finance and cryptocurrency and Bitcoin mining, all sorts of great futuristic stuff. I am joined today by an SPPI regular, Mr. John Berlaw. He is the director of finance policy and senior fellow with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And I am also joined today by Eric Peterson. Eric Peterson is the policy director with the Satoshi Action Fund. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me today. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me,
Patrick.
Super. Well, John, I think you have some great news that I wanted to start off with. You are now followed on Twitter by Mr. Mark Cuban. That's exciting. Congratulations.
Yes, I am. I couldn't believe it. I was checking to see if it was like a fake profile, but he followed me after, and I don't know exactly why, but I think this has something to do with it. I had a tweet that went viral, 5,000 views, about blasting the SEC's attack on unprecedented and unwarranted attack on the cryptocurrency exchange Coinbase, and it had 5,000 views. And then late last night, I got a notification that Mark Cuban was following me, and he's expressed similar criticism of the SEC for what they're doing to Coinbase shareholders, of which I am among them, for not printing. Said when they're saying, "Oh, it's so easy to register," pointing on their website anything, a roadmap to how exactly a crypto exchange registers, just like, and not accounting for the difference in the stock, and say crypto and stocks and bonds and exchange for them. And so it's, a lot of people, including Mark Cuban, are being upset at what the Biden administration is doing. And it's sort of a whole of government assault on crypto.
Sure, sure. John, that's a great lead into the rest of the conversation. Let's take a step back, though, and define for our audience exactly what cryptocurrency is, what Bitcoin is, how they are, what mining is in the cryptocurrency space, what the difference is between a security, a commodity, and why is the SEC going after all of these different cryptocurrencies? I don't know who wants to take that. If you want to take that, John, or if you want to toss that over to Eric.
It over to Eric. I have my own views about why the why it's not a security, but I think Eric might give a better introduction.
Yeah, why don't we just start with what is Bitcoin and then sort of go from there, because it is the sort of genesis of cryptocurrency. So Bitcoin is the first cryptocurrency. It's not the first virtual currency. There were a few virtual currencies before the creation of Bitcoin by Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever that happens to be. Nobody is quite sure who he is, but it created some new things for virtual currency. One, and most importantly, is that it created a process known as the blockchain, which allowed people to verify transactions of different virtual currencies to make sure there wasn't a double spending problem. So if I have my password to my Bitcoin, then I am in control of that and only in control of that. And if I send it to you, Patrick, everybody on the Bitcoin network can see where that Bitcoin went, and that's verified. And then since then, there has been a variety of other cryptocurrencies to spin up over the period of time, trying to do different sorts of things. For Ethereum, it's things like smart contracts, which allow for the creation of virtual goods to trade back and forth. For other blockchains, it's been used for things like analytics. Walmart uses blockchain to do tracking. And as these certain different cryptocurrencies have spawned up, there have been different regulators who have tried to take different approaches to exactly what these things are, because our securities laws go all the way back to the 1930s, certainly a time before the internet, before computers, and certainly before virtual currency.
Sure, sure. We're not going to get into any of the privacy concerns that are associated with crypto and with the decentralized nature and all of the ledgers that are associated with transaction, because all of that stuff is the intention of the Bitcoin networks and all of those things to expose those transactional data points. I mean, you there is full transparency about every transaction that takes place on the Merkle tree or origins. So why is the SEC going after all of these cryptocurrencies? John, yeah. I mean, that's how you got Mark Cuban involved. You were talking about some of the SEC litigation that's going on. I don't know, John, what was the tweet that got his attention?
The tweet was a tweet that I did that was very critical of the SEC lawsuit seeking to, in their words, restrain Coinbase for crypto that was never declared in a security until the actual complaint came out on Tuesday. But the SEC is really just stretching its power from the Congress in the way that hopefully, if Congress doesn't come up with new legislation, I think the courts could and should very well rein in, given the cases where they're talking about, like, say, the major questions doctrine, where the agencies can't, stretch a rule to make, or stretch what the law says to make policy. They're saying that cryptocurrencies are securities basically because they have investment value and people buy them as investments. Well, there are a lot of things people buy as investments or partially as investments that don't come under the SEC's jurisdiction, including baseball cards, comic books, wine. I mean, many, many other things, pieces of art. And now, so if the SEC stretches its power for that, what else could, come under its jurisdiction? Could gold coins, could other things? And this is especially the case with things like non-fungible tokens that can go and, help, using the blockchain that Eric mentioned, help authenticate things like, pieces of art, show that, if you have this blockchain code, that it's not a forgery. So it really is a power grab by the SEC. And I think, like with other power grabs, and expansions of power, like with Sarbanes-Oxley and all the red tape on smaller public companies, it meant a lot of companies don't go public until they're larger. It means that average investors and savers and users of Bitcoin are going to lose out, while the rich could always, go to a foreign exchange, qualify for the accredited investor exemption and get it. So as average Americans who are going to be losing out is something as a potential good use and could be part of a diversified portfolio.
Yeah, and this is the Coinbase lawsuit. Let's talk about Coinbase. What is Coinbase in the context of cryptocurrency? It's an exchange,
right? It is an exchange, or I would say a venue. There are lots of different exchanges other than stock exchanges. There's also Amazon and eBay could be considered exchange as far as products. And in fact, one of the reasons I was noticing, and this is something I think we have to rethink our securities laws in general, that eBay, you could, buy a gas station, but you couldn't buy a part of a gas station. In rules I had viewed and written about a few years ago, because the part of the gas station would be considered a security, a piece of a business. So that was, I thought maybe that has to be revised, but that was a standard definition. But now they're just saying it's basically first, the SEC was saying it's doubling down on everything and combining everything bad the SEC has been. They're saying that crypto is like we know it when we see it, that a crypto is a security, that for some reason Bitcoin and Ethereum are not, but XRP and others are, even though they share the same properties. But here they were saying, all right, you've been carrying these securities for years. They've always been securities, even though we haven't said anything, we haven't issued any warning, and you should have known, and therefore we need to restrain you and shut you down. I mean, it would be basically like if the government were to try to declare, like, say, a food or a drug or a toy unhealthy. First of all, there's a process for that. But second, you just don't go said, okay, grocery store, you've been carrying cornflakes for years, and cornflakes is an illegal, unhealthy food product. So therefore, we need to shut you down because you've been carrying it, even though there have been no warnings that it was against the law.
Wow. Wow, that's major. Those are some major implications. Eric, I'm sorry, I interrupted you earlier. What were you were chiming on?
No, I think John just made a really good point about what the SEC is trying to define as security. One of the things that they say is a security is Filecoin. And what Filecoin does is they sell Filecoins, which allow for cloud storage. So in a lot of ways, they're just like tokens that you might use to buy for Amazon Web Services storage, Google Cloud storage, or Apple storage. They just have the properties of a certain token and that they might move in price. So when we're talking about what the SEC is trying to claim jurisdiction of over here, John's right in that they're asking for broad jurisdiction among a lot of different types of cryptocurrencies or tokens that have very different properties and really could be fundamental building blocks to the next version of the internet.
Major implications.
Yes, to Web3, that's very important. I mean, people were using, one of the things they declared illegal security was also a Polygon that was competing with the Ethereum blockchain, which then the Ether token for people using that for NFTs, for things like stable coins that used to hold the dollar or a dollar equivalent that give easier access to the dollar. So a lot of innovations could be affected if there's less liquidity in cryptocurrency, or if you have a question in legality, because oftentimes they're just tokens. And there are antecedents. We've had tokens in arcades and casinos for years, and sometimes there was even a third party market. Like there was something called trading stamps. One of the things was S&H green stamps in the 60s that were sort of like grocery store, the equivalent of credit card rewards back then. And there were third party markets for those. At the same time, the SEC, was in existence. It had been in existence in the 1930s, and there was no call to regulate those as securities back then. So if you look beyond crypto, and it's the SEC just really trying to stretch its power over a lot of different products.
Sure. I've been personally impacted by some of the stuff going on with the SEC overreaching. I want to take a minute and talk about my story with just trying to acquire a particular coin currency. And that was XRP. XRP is the coin that is operated by Ripple, and Ripple is the company. And just to acquire XRP right now is interesting. Coinbase delisted the XRP currency as a result of the SEC's litigation with XRP. XRP was claimed to be representing itself as a unregistered security by the SEC. So there's litigation there. And when that litigation took place, Coinbase, the exchange, delisted XRP. So in order for me, just a private citizen, to acquire some of this XRP, I had to take a number of really interesting steps, and it felt dirty. It felt like I was laundering money. I went to Coinbase. I bought a US dollar coin and exchanged my US dollar for this US dollar coin. And then I transacted that away from Coinbase, the exchange, because I couldn't actually buy XRP on the Coinbase exchange. I moved that US dollar coin to KuCoin, which is another exchange. It's a foreign exchange where you can acquire XRP. I moved my dollar coin to KuCoin. I transacted there. I just bought it as a market buy. Acquired like 5,000 coins, which was at the time like $2,000. It's up about 25% in the last 30 days, which I'm really happy with. But there's going to be some clawback from that. I think people are going to take their earnings. That's fine. But I believe in the XRP because of the real broad-based potential for XRP as a international exchange mechanism. So I bought the XRP on KuCoin, and then I moved it to a hardware wallet. I used Ledger on the advice of a good friend. It was as secure as any of the other ones. Bought my little my little Ledger hardware wallet, and then moved my money from KuCoin to the hardware Ledger. But at each step in that process, I mean, that's scary. You screw up in that process and you're out all your money if you accidentally send it to the wrong hardware wallet, or you don't include there are notes or something that are required in certain transactions when you're moving your own money. And that wouldn't have been necessary if Coinbase hadn't delisted XRP, and that wouldn't have been necessary if the SEC wasn't overstepping its authority.
Yeah, I think you got to highlight really the nature of the problem that the SEC is getting at, which is the more that they overstep their bounds, it's not that people can't transact in cryptocurrency. Obviously, it's sort of a borderless, stateless thing. But it's that people are going to move to offshore exchanges. And that is by far and away more dangerous to consumers than being able to purchase on Coinbase or Kraken or a U.S. regulated exchange that goes through a variety of auditing to make sure that they're not commingling funds, they're not stealing them, they're not using them for their own devices. If you look at what happened with FTX, you know, a lot of people say, oh, this is the fault of U.S. regulators for not coming down, when it turns out that, you know, FTX hadn't gotten a license in the United States. The all the sort of fraud that was going on was outside of their jurisdiction. So when the U.S. Has a sort of hostile attitude towards companies that want to comply and want to provide a safe system for folks who want to purchase various cryptocurrencies for whatever reason, they're putting a lot of, you know, U.S. consumers at risk, because the genie is sort of already out of the bottle on cryptocurrency. As folks said, you can't uninvent Bitcoin or Ethereum or any of these cryptocurrencies. They're going to be out there. It's just a question of what are the steps that people have to take to get them. And generally, if the U.S. wants to lead on this new and innovative technology, clear rules of the road that protect consumers are going to be the way to go, rather than trying to move people to offshore exchanges, which seems to be what the SEC is looking to do right now.
So in the process of trying to protect consumers, the SEC has, in effect, endangered consumers with their overly aggressive attitude toward crypto.
Exactly. And no fraud was alleged in the Coinbase suit or the, you know, against the cryptocurrency XRP. In fact, Coinbase did an initial public offering supervised by the SEC, and they are pointing out, and I should disclose if I haven't, I'm a Coinbase shareholder, that they were doing the exact same activities that now the SEC is going after them for, that when they put in the IPO in 2021 that Gary Gensler's SEC approved.
Yeah, I would go to say even more, John, is that when the U.S. government has taken the Bitcoin that they have seized due to crimes, where they've gone to sell the Bitcoin is in fact on Coinbase. So you have the U.S. government willing to do business and sell their Coinbase for U.S. dollars with that exchange, and then just a few months later have the SEC go and sue them for the exact activity that the U.S. government engaged in business with them. And that's wild. Yeah, it's just yeah. Wild.
Or the hypocrisy. Sorry. Right. Yeah. Oh, the hypocrisy. That's hilarious. So they will take over funds. They will take over crypto that has been that they've seized. The SEC will seize cryptocurrency, and then they will go back and sell it using Coinbase.
Yeah, so the SEC had not sold it, but the various law enforcement agencies, sure, of the United States, you know, going back to Silk Road and some other cases that they found, yeah, they were holding a lot of Bitcoin and they wanted to turn that into cash. I believe it was close to $1 billion that they had deposited on the Coinbase exchange for dollars. And then again, obviously, you know, not every part of the government sees eye to eye, but you know, the fact that they're willing to do business with Coinbase, which has 50% of all crypto activity in the United States, is one of the most trusted entities, for a few months later to come back and sue them for that very activity, specifically exchanging dollars for cryptocurrency, just in this case, Bitcoin, it is, you know, the height of hypocrisy.
Wow. So Eric, I want you to talk more about Satoshi Action Fund, what you do, how you got involved. Tell us more.
Yeah, so I have worked in state policy for almost 10 years, and so I'm a big fan of what you guys are doing in the Southwest, because I like to say most people don't live in Washington, D.C. Most people live in states, and the policies of state governments matter a lot to individuals. I'd been working in tech policy for about 5 years, and there I got really interested in cryptocurrency in Web3, especially as we're talking about. One of the reasons the SEC has had the power to go with these lawsuits is Congress has failed to act on sort of really thorough regulations of this new industry. And so it's been left up to the states to come up with their own guardrails around this technology. And Satoshi Action Fund is a fairly new group. It's about a year old. And we engaged specifically at the state level on behalf of Bitcoin, the Bitcoin ecosystem, and Bitcoin mining. And I can get into any one of those three around the different policies around them. But we take a very specific state level approach, which is different than a lot of the other great folks doing good work in Washington, D.C. But we felt that there's this really big unmet need in state houses across the country, especially on a new and emerging technology like Bitcoin.
Sure. Why, in your experience on the state level, has there been a lot of state pushback on the action of Bitcoin mining?
Yeah. So let me take a step back and say what Bitcoin mining is.
Yeah.
So we've been talking a little bit about cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin. If you're sending Bitcoin to each other, so if I'm sending it to you, Patrick, you actually need computers to process those transactions. And so the people who are purchasing the computers to process those transactions, they are known as Bitcoin miners. They engage in something that is known as proof of work mining, which is suffice to say they buy very powerful specialized computers that use a lot of energy to process those transactions and to make sure that they're secure and there's no fraud in those transactions. Now, about 3 years ago, China decided to ban Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining from their shores due to obviously the nature of Bitcoin being an uncontrollable digital currency, something that the Communist Party was really upset with. And so you had a huge movement of capital to the United States, partially due to America's energy revolution with fracking and natural gas to more renewables coming online, to the point that something like 50% of those Bitcoin data centers are in the United States right now, with Texas having about 25% of the worldwide amount of Bitcoin miners, and the rest being the other 25% being scattered across the United States. So the sort of big headline about this has been New York last year placed a 2-year moratorium on all Bitcoin mining in the state that didn't use 100% renewable energy. So in the state level over the past year or so, you started to see more pushback on states due to its energy use or due to concerns about noise. And so we've really engaged on that because we think that Bitcoin mining can be a really important tool for energy development, for grid stability, and even improving the environment, funnily enough. And we can talk a little bit about that and some opportunities for Bitcoin to clean up the environment right there in New Mexico.
Sure. Well, New Mexico itself, the largest utility provider, PNM, recently just exited its ownership in the Palo Verde Nuclear Generating Station. And I'm personally heavily supportive of the nuclear industry. And we've actually just partnered with Holtec International. Holtec International has there's some problems with this, and it's not Holtec's fault, but Holtec International is responsible for the interim storage facility in the southeast part of the state. They're going to be storing spent nuclear fuel down there. It is not waste, and I don't like the erroneous nature associated with nuclear waste. It is spent nuclear fuel. There's limitations for what can be done with it, but New Mexico could be a major player in the nuclear energy space, but politicians in Santa Fe continue to butt heads with nuclear energy leaders, and we all agree that nuclear energy results in zero net carbon emissions. It's clean energy, it's renewable, it's reliable, it's cheap, it's plentiful, it's safe. Why are we seeing so many states take such a hostile attitude to nuclear energy? And that being said, why is there so much hostility in storing nuclear spent fuel safely? I don't understand that. But we didn't come here to talk all about nuclear. We came to talk about the implications of the state policy on Bitcoin mining, on cryptocurrency. In New York, this might be a tough question. Does New York consider nuclear energy green as part of the renewable energy only mandate for Bitcoin mining?
I can't speak to that directly. I could tell you the genesis of the pushback, which was there was a coal facility that was in upstate New York that was shuttered for closure. Some Bitcoin miners ended up purchasing it and sort of keeping it open longer. And that was sort of the genesis of their being upset about Bitcoin mining up there. There was a lot of misinformation. They talked about the Bitcoin miners like boiling the lakes and things of that nature, which was just not true. But they also had a lot of hydroelectric. And, you know, oftentimes you're generating more energy on the hydroelectric dam than there is actual demand. And of course, there are physical limitations for how far you can transfer energy. And so a lot of Bitcoin miners up in New York right now are just sort of purchasing that extra energy right there. Again, talking about nuclear energy, Bitcoin miners often locate right next to nuclear facilities, and any of sort of excess generation, they're able to monetize by taking that energy, paying for it, and then using it to generate new Bitcoin when they're processing those transactions. So you really have this ability to take energy that would otherwise be wasted and not make it to market and really create value by securing the Bitcoin network, allowing people to send value across the world almost instantaneously for very cheaply, and you know, really benefiting the energy market and people as a whole.
You brought up some really good points when we first started the conversation, John, talking about some of the litigation that was going on. And I want to pitch it back over to you. Tell us about, just give us a handful, exactly what cases are most pressing, what cases are currently being considered that will have the greatest either positive or negative impact on cryptocurrency and decentralized finance.
Well, on XRP, it has taken a long time since 2021, but it looks like some of those cases, the company has fought back and is challenging the SEC's attempt to shut it down in the U.S. in the SEC versus Ripple case. And that case, and I believe in the Second Circuit in New York, there were several discovery motions that the SEC, as far as getting documents from the SEC and the decision, because there were so many irregularities that Ripple had been XRP had been around since 2013, and the first time the SEC declared that a crypto could be a security wasn't until 4 years in 2017. It had meetings with the SEC where apparently its officials said it was not a security. And so there were attempts to get those documents, but a decision on the merits may be coming in a couple weeks. I mean, in addition, I mean, I think there are also users, you know, holders, customers like you and XRP who have a case there. In addition, I mean, Coinbase so far has said it is going to, you know, it's not going to capitulate because it doesn't know. The SEC really didn't tell them how exactly they registered. So, and it submitted plans to do that. So they are fighting this in court. And I think, you know, there probably should be, given that this is one of the circuits that that really clamped down, you know, was really clamping down on agencies to try to stretch their power. The Fifth Circuit, in Louisiana, in parts of Texas, where Eric is, you know, being in New Orleans, and I think probably there should be, and I expect there might be some peremptory challenges about the SEC's actions in the Fifth Circuit. So we should be seeing, I mean, hopefully the courts will just see that, you know, this is a power grab no matter what the technology is, and that these agencies are exceeding the law and, you know, consistent with the Supreme Court's major questions case involving the EPA last year, that they will just see that, you know, this authority to regulate crypto as a security, or to regulate crypto at all other than, you know, the general fraud laws, which apply to everything, has to come from Congress.
Yes. Yes. So the EPA is now getting involved. And that's
no,
because...
I use the EPA. I at least so far, I don't know. But I'm saying the EPA versus West Virginia case, mm-hmm. in which the court ruled like that it stretched the Clean Water Act to say that these little streams were actually waterways, that it was stretching the law, that there's a similar analogy in the way that the SEC is stretching, that saying these cryptocurrencies are securities, the same as stocks and bonds, and we have jurisdiction. Well, Congress never said that. Congress is the one who writes the laws and tells the agencies what to do. The agency, not the unelected bureaucrats of the agency. So there are cases, you know, challenging that based on the reasoning the Supreme Court made in EPA in West Virginia, and what was called the major questions, that like if something, you know, changes like the regulatory landscape or has like a big impact on the way business is done, that you need to make sure that there's a special scrutiny to make sure that the agencies actually have this authority from Congress. And so this is certainly changing the cryptocurrency landscape, affecting, you know, customers, crypto holders, billions of dollars worth of business. So I think that those precedents from the Supreme Court that were done to agencies like the EPA would apply here.
Okay. Now, given the rate of, given the playing field and the tendency of the SEC, I haven't read on all the cases, but the cases where I've done some light reading, the SEC is losing. They've lost a considerable number of these cases. Where do you see crypto policy going as a result of the SEC's intervention, and then also the SEC's losing streak?
The SEC has lost a lot of related cases. I don't know how many crypto cases they've actually lost, because until recently they haven't challenged the big players. But I think if you look at some of the things, and the fact that you've got groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, not the cryptocurrency related Chamber of Digital Commerce, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce saying this is a threat to for regulatory uncertainty for all business, what they're doing with Coinbase, that you're going to see I think you will eventually probably see something going to the Supreme Court, and if the court majority applies its and hopefully it'll be unanimous that what this the SEC's action will be lawless, but if certainly the majority of the court does it, if it's consistent, you'll see that they will rule that the SEC is exceeding its power unless Congress stops the SEC first.
Yeah, the other thing you might see, I think John hit the nail on the head there, is essentially the SEC has been relying on a Supreme Court test, which has been the Howey test. Now, if you get one of these cases that goes all the way there, you might see the Supreme Court decide a new test is needed, or totally throw out the Howey test in terms of, you know, how securities law are decided at all. I think, you know, the SEC, from their case, would probably prefer that not happen. They would probably like to see a settlement. But so far, you know, judging from the statements from Coinbase, they don't seem to have any interest in a settlement, because they're so interested in their regulatory certainty. And in fact, they have a case in the Third Circuit where they've essentially asked the court to force the SEC to come up with a ruling so they can know how to act properly. So suffice to say, I think this is going to take some time, but the implications could be felt widely, not just for the cryptocurrency landscape.
And because this is such a new issue to the United States, I mean, cryptocurrencies has been around for how long? 10 years, 15 years? When was Bitcoin still like 40 cents?
2009 would be like the sort of start date of Bitcoin. And, you know, you're not talking about any kind of, I wouldn't say mass adoption, but, you know, getting Bitcoin off of the message boards in exchange is, you know, didn't happen to quite a few years later. So you're talking about an industry that's just about a decade old.
Right. This is uncharted territory, and the decisions that are made now will impact the future of the industry forever, potentially.
Right.
So it's important that they get it right.
Case, I hope it is thrown out. It gave the SEC too broad authority. But I would say even under the broad authority and the Supreme Court granted the SEC in that case in 1946, in which they ruled that fixed investment contracts for orange groves were somehow securities. I would say this goes further than even that, because they were making the case that this is the investment contract. It was dependent on the maintenance of the orange grove, and the fact that people didn't get oranges themselves. I would argue here the cryptocurrency, which trades itself, is not like those parts of the orange grove, but rather the oranges themselves. I mean, it is the commodity. It is the object of the investment contract, rather than being an investment contract itself. And what they're saying now is also, this was never a part of the Howey case, you know, how valuable the oranges would be, that something with investment value is a security. I mean, what could, as I've said before, what could that apply to? I mean, baseball cards, comic books, a lot of things have investment value and are sold as an investment that are not securities. And, you know, it's basically, plus things like, you know, like where you trade like rewards on points.com. I mean, are those something digital? Are those securities? So the SEC really is going beyond even, I think, the authority for Howey. So even within that precedent, I think they, you know, the courts will see a need to limit the agency.
Yeah, one thing I think John hit the nail on the head on the hammer there, but one aspect of the Coinbase case, which was really interesting, is they were suggesting that Coinbase's staking as a service was a security in and of itself. And not to get into the nitty gritty, but essentially the staking as a service allowed some people to take certain cryptocurrencies, lock them up on the exchange for a period of time, and it would pay out essentially what is interest. It would pay out 3%, 4%, 5% in that native token. And they were saying that was a security. I mean, if that's the case, that's a lot like just taking money, putting it into a high yield savings account where the bank lends it out and you get a return on it, or buying treasuries. So, I mean, are we talking about like everybody's high yield savings account being a security now? Because that's really kind of what we're talking about with this, with that staking as a service program. So we're talking on some broad overreach potentially from the SEC on the various aspects of that actual case.
Okay, I want to take a step back here. What is for those in the audience that don't know, what is staking when it comes to cryptocurrency?
Yeah, so we talked a little bit earlier about Bitcoin mining, which is using all of those computers to process Bitcoin transactions. There's another way to secure blockchain networks for Ethereum, for Polygon, for basically any other cryptocurrency we're talking about, which is known as proof of stake. Again, it's simply taking an amount of a cryptocurrency, locking it up for a period of time, running a small computer that processes these transactions. That process can be very complicated for individual users. And it can also be very expensive, because there's a limit or a minimum amount that you have to deposit in order to participate in this program. Coinbase essentially said, hey, we're going to take away a lot of that technical work that you might have to do. You can deposit any amount of these cryptocurrencies that apply this way with us. We'll take a fee for doing so, but you will be entitled to some of those rewards. And unlike a lot of other market processes, because these things are algorithmic and coded into the blockchain, you can know exactly essentially how much return in that native cryptocurrency you are going to get. And it was the SEC's contention that offering this as a service was a security.
And that's because the SEC saw the money being given back to the fee being given back to the holder of the cryptocurrency, and they interpreted that as a dividend. Is that right?
Yeah, they basically said that Coinbase, that you were giving a cryptocurrency to Coinbase, you know, there was an expectation of profit, and that it was based solely on the work of others, in this case being Coinbase. That's not really what's going on there. They're simply just allowing you to access a mechanism that exists on that blockchain that is also crucial for that blockchain to function. Let's not forget this. Without staking, none of these blockchains work. So we're really talking about a baseline function for the entire Web3 cryptocurrency industry. And they're basically saying it's a security. And if offering that service to customers is a security, and you, the only way to avoid that is doing it yourself, that really takes the ability for individual people to participate in this new Web3 economy out entirely, because it raises the bar for technical expertise and investment to an incredibly high level.
I mean, there are lots of things where you get, you know, extra points, extra digital assets, as you will. I mean, you stay somewhere, you stay at a hotel for two nights, and you get extra rewards points. So, I mean, is that a security? I mean, that's the thing. How it's like limitless the power the SEC is claiming, unless you go. Unless the court's limited. And also, Eric had mentioned when China banned it, China has it now a central bank, the digital yuan. And that's actually what the Biden administration, some of the officials have been proposing, is, you know, they're attacking this privately issued cryptocurrency. At the same time, they want to push a central bank digital currency that would have tons of problems, like having the government having access to the blockchain or the ledger or whatever they keep the transactions on, where they would see everyone's transaction and what you were spending and what, and that, and could block basically some things that the government thinks are inappropriate.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of speculation about what Gary Gensler thinks the future of potential digital currencies is. And I would just say he went on CNBC the day of the Coinbase lawsuit and said, you don't need a digital currency other than the digital dollar. He was being very clear about where he stands on any sort of privately issued cryptocurrency. He doesn't think Americans should need it or, frankly, potentially have access to it.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to SPPI TV. This is episode 12, Bitcoin and Decentralized Finance. I'm here still with Eric Peterson, the policy director with the Satoshi Action Fund, and who is turning out to be our regular, John Burlaw, the director of finance policy and a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. This is the public policy podcast of the Southwest Public Policy Institute. You can find out more about the Southwest Public Policy Institute at Southwest Public Policy. Southwestpolicy.com. You can find out more about the Satoshi Action Fund at satoshiaction.io, and you can find out more about the Competitive Enterprise Institute at cei.org. You can help us keep these events free. The podcast is free. It's available on Spotify, Google Podcasts, everywhere podcasts are available. Whatever your favorite podcasting platform is, go there. We're there. SPPI-TV. We also broadcast these live every Friday at 1 p.m. Mountain Time. We try to keep the conversations limited to about an hour. We've got 15 minutes left. I've got some really exciting questions for these fellas, and I'm going to put them on the spot. If you had a magic eight ball, Eric and John, what would you say where are we going to be in 12 months? On all of this policy and all the SEC stuff, where are we going to be in 12 months? Where are we going to be in 24 months? If you could see the future, what do you think is going to happen? I want to record it now so that when you're right, 12 months from now, we can point back and say you heard it here first. Eric, you want to take a shot at that?
Yeah, okay. It's a big question. I'll say in the next 12 months, Congress is unfortunately going to fail to add any clarity to this. You know, this is why Satoshi Action Fund is at the state level. You're seeing states like California, Illinois, New Jersey, even Texas, take really big shots at solving the problems of consumer protections around cryptocurrency. What exactly paths those take and how effective those are and how much they allow for innovation will obviously be subject to a matter of debates. As far as the cases go, I think we have not talked about the case against Binance. I think that is a much stronger case because they're actually alleging fraud. I think the Coinbase lawsuit, where they allege no fraud, the SEC will probably try to settle that because they're going to be afraid of a bad Supreme Court ruling or a potential change in administration that it will likely be more favorable towards cryptocurrency and other digital assets than the current Biden administration is. I think they tried to give themselves enough time and to cause enough trouble to Coinbase that they'll ultimately settle on some of these questions. Whether or not Coinbase is interested in settling, I think remains to be seen. I will go ahead and say I don't think that they will settle. I think they're really interested in getting this all the way up to the Supreme Court because I think the potential benefits to them without Congress acting are so great.
Okay. Well, you know, hopefully we can look back in 12 months and say that you were right on all the right things or all the positive things and wrong on all the bad stuff. So, you know, fingers crossed, say a prayer if you're a praying man. John, same question to you. Where do you think we're going to be in 12 and 24 months? What do you think?
Well, I think the one thing I can say with certainty is I think this is going to become an issue in the presidential campaigns. It already is, as far as both restrictions on privately issued cryptocurrency and central bank digital currency. You've got Bobby Kennedy Jr. defending crypto and, you know, calling out central bank digital currency, and as well as some on the Republican side like Ron DeSantis. And I think on both the primaries and the general elections, I think this could potentially become an issue, particularly with the Biden administration pushing central bank digital currency. And also the Trump administration didn't have as, you know, stellar a record. It had some good appointees like Hester Peirce at the SEC. But of course, Jay Clayton was the one as chairman that actually pursued the lawsuit against XRP and did and said that many cryptos were securities. He didn't, you know, and Gary Gensler has been, you know, 10 times worse on the issue as chairman of the SEC. But you're going to see it being discussed probably in, you know, the presidential primaries and in the general election. And, you know, and of course, we're, you know, we don't take any positions on, you know, candidates, but it's just going to be, I think it's going to be a public policy issue that's more front and center in some of these political campaigns, especially with, you know, with younger people using crypto, and you've got central bank digital currency, the digital dollar, becoming more of an issue, where there was a recent poll where only 17% were in favor, and even Democrats and independents were skeptical of it.
Yeah, I'll just say on that, a recent Fed paper came out that said something about 10 to 11% of Americans currently own and hold cryptocurrency, which you might not think that's a large amount, but that's 30 million people. And 30 million people who are very interested in potentially voting on one issue and can be swayed on that. And so I think this will indeed continue to be a political issue. And as John said, especially an issue for younger people, where the number or the percentage of young people who are invested in these currencies is much, much higher.
Okay. That's interesting. I think the timing is only going to get, there's only more pressure, especially now with, I want to talk about FedNow. FedNow is going live in July. What impact do you think that service is going to have on this space? Because FedNow is that service that's being developed by the Federal Reserve for depository institutions, and it will enable businesses and individuals to send and receive instant payments. How does that apply to the cryptocurrency and Bitcoin conversation, as we've been talking about for the last half an hour?
Well, FedNow is not, and there's been some inaccurate information that it's not the same as a central bank digital currency, but it is still pretty bad. It is basically doing, first of all, I mean, like with CBDCs, I mean, what is the need? You already have, supposedly it's justified by its defenders at the Fed, and now Lael Brainard, who's went from the Fed governor to Treasury, as well, we need faster payments, but you were already getting that from privately issued cryptocurrency, from payment apps like fintech payment apps, and you were getting that from like the services such as the clearinghouse that banks were already doing. What it basically was doing is it just kind of slowed real time payments down, and it was sort of a conflict of interest for the Fed to be at the same time, which regulates banks, to be selling this to banks. And there are privacy concerns that the Fed has access to those payments. It's not as much as maybe the digital dollar, that it's going to know, you know, who made them. So I think, you know, we might see some, you know, just you have the government potentially crowding out innovation in payments and faster payments, but also some, you know, just other, some of the same damaging effects of, you know, a central bank digital currency, even though it's not quite the same thing.
You've got the government regulating the industry at the same time it's participating and competing with the rest of the industry.
Exactly. But, you know,
with FedNow coming out, when is July? July, next month. Next month, 2023.
It's been delayed, and I sort of almost went a route for government inefficiency so many times that originally it was going to come out like 2020, and now it's 2023. But what this has basically done is that, you know, the private group, the cooperative, the clearinghouse, was supposed to have it basically by like I think 2019, and then what happens when the and was, you know, adding, you know, at a rapid pace these banks, and then what happened when the Fed say, well, we're going to have our own competing service, is the banks were saying, well, wait a minute, we got to wait for the Fed. So it slowed down adoption of this. So this is, I have a paper on this, you know, you put FedNow on our website that you mentioned, CEI.org. And it was just, but it's, and as well as a newer, you know, update on this, but it slowed down and, you know, has crowded out innovation. So, I mean, but that could be, I mean, that's not the worst damage it could do, but July is the target date they're announcing, but I wouldn't be surprised if that would be delayed, and it might not be such a bad thing if it were delayed. I hope the Fed just basically gives it up.
Sure, but with next month rolling around in less than 30 days, it doesn't look like they are going to give up the ghost. So what happens?
They're not going to give up. I mean, that's the thing. If they give up, they would provide certainty to it. But I don't know if it's going to be. It might be delayed past July, and they might say we're still working on it, and that leaves, I mean, the banks and people are using it in a state of uncertainty, but we still have, I mean, we're solving the problem. I mean, supposedly one of the things is, like, you know, the check doesn't clear for your account sometimes until a few days later. We're having things like payment apps where you can get an advance, sort of like with small dollar loans, an advance, you know, on your paycheck, so you can have that check sometimes with, you know, free or really small fee. And then you also have things like crypto, things like stable coins, where you can send, you know, that's reducing the cost of remittances, as well as the banks that do have things like Zelle and the clearinghouse that you know have, you know, the faster or instant payments. So I don't know, but I mean, this is the thing. I mean, the big danger from FedNow is that it could disrupt it and having its own issues, like with privacy, the same as central bank digital currency, and being sort of a precursor for central bank digital currency.
Okay, tough stuff, futuristic stuff. Really exciting stuff when you can really drill down into it. Eric, I want to toss it back to you for closing remarks. Give us your 30-second elevator pitch. Let's leave the audience with something that they can... it was already a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. But give them something to remember you by.
Yeah, I would just say here over at Satoshi Action Fund, we really believe in the States. We know that it can just take a few people, the people listening to this podcast right now, to go talk to your state elected officials. Oftentimes, they do not have strong opinions about cryptocurrency or the future of money, but states are going to play a large role in it. And if you're interested, obviously reach out to us, but you can really make a difference in your state capital. That's what we believe in. And we believe in the power of people just like you to make their state a better place that they want to live.
Super. Thank you, Eric. It was a pleasure having you on. John, I want to pitch it back to you for closing remarks. I'm hoping I'm going to get both of you on again soon. John, I know that we're going to be in touch on the further work that we're doing in short-term lending. We've got some really exciting stuff in the works, folks. We're launching or publishing or announcing, whatever, the release of No Loan For You 2. That's No Loan For You TOO. So stay tuned for that. Really exciting shoe leather reporting journalistic work. work on short-term lending as we continue to conduct our essential exit interview study of lenders as they've departed from the state of New Mexico now that we've got the interest rate cap going that took effect January 1. It is creating a credit access crisis, and we really want to focus on the consumer, advocating what is best for the consumer. But John, they can find out more about the Competitive Enterprise Institute at CEI.org. Let's do closing remarks for you.
It's a pleasure to be on the show, and let's hope for the best in public policy. And people, you know, should engage their, you know, their government officials, their state and federal representatives on cryptocurrency and a bunch of other issues, and fight for more freedom for individuals to build wealth and pursue their lives. That's what we stand for, the freedom to prosper at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org.
I think that's what we all stand for here at the Southwest Public Policy Institute, at the Satoshi Action Fund, at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, our audience. We all stand for that, those very ideals. They are what make our country so great. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for tuning in to another great episode of SPPI TV. Many thanks to Eric Peterson and John Berlaw for joining me today as we discussed Bitcoin and decentralized finance. You can find out more about the Southwest Public Policy Institute at southwestpolicy.com, and you can help us keep these events free. The Southwest Public Policy Institute is a 501c3 nonprofit charitable organization, and donations to the Institute are tax deductible. You can contribute to the Institute by going to donate.southwestpolicy.com. Thank you so much for joining us again today, and we'll see you next week.